Good evening. My name is Andrew Kimorowski, and a member of the Clark Forum Student Board. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Office of the Dean Students, I would like to welcome you to this evening's program, Gender and the Search of and the Search for Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, the first Clark Forum Student Board-initiated program. Beginning from birth, we as a society reinforce the notion of only two gender identities, established by one's anatomy, as evidenced from the color and stitching on clothing to the activities children participate in. American society ascribes specific roles to male and female, and believes there is only the male and female genders. But what happens to the boy who wants to wear the tutu, or the girl who likes to throw the football? As a parent, you might say it's only a phase, but you really are worried that your child will be deemed as abnormal by society. Today, we are slowly coming to terms with the reality that gender is not binary, because so many people do not fit into one ascribed category or another. Tonight, we have two speakers who will share their own compelling stories of what can happen when you go against the societal notion of gender. Bear Bergman, an author, theater artist, and gender jammer, has been lecturing colleges and universities about issues relating to gender and sexuality, and wrote a critically acclaimed book, Butch Is a Noun. One of the five founding members of the first Gay-Straight Alliance, Z has also worked ever since to raise awareness of the problems gay and transgender communities face. Z wrote the moving poem, Day of Remembrance, often read the Transgender Day of Remembrance, a day to memorialize those who were killed due to anti-transgender hatred or prejudice, that tells of the hatred and fear transgender people face. Julie Nemechek is a former university professor and minister. She now leads her own consulting firm, Julie Nemechek Consulting. During her tenure at Spring Arbor University, Julie underwent a prescribed treatment for her diagnosed condition as a transsexual, after which the university fired her for unchristian-like behavior. Afterwards, she formed Julie Nemechek Consulting, where she advises organizations on diversity issues and also advocates for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transsexual rights. She also has been lobbying the federal government for the passage of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, also known as EDNA, legislation that's still being considered today, that extends the rights of the Civil Rights Act to include protection based on sexual orientation as well as gender identity. Before we begin, I would like to ask that the sound be disabled on any cell phones or pagers. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation, when there will be a question-and-answer session. Because this evening's program is being recorded, and now of courtesy to our guests who may be hearing impaired, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to reach you before posing your question. Thank you for your cooperation. And now, join me in welcoming Julie Nemechek and Bear Bergman.
Good evening. How is everyone? I'm always really attracted to podiums because I'm a leaner. So I think I'll stand behind the podium and then I can, you know, and that's when I run into trouble, so I don't do that anymore. So I'm just going to stand here, and you can all see and hear me fine, and that's okay. It's not too jarring. I have notes. There we go. Which I obviously prepared well in advance. Can I see a show of hands for who was at Common Hour? So many of you. Okay. Well, it's one of those, I don't want to repeat myself extensively things. For those of you who weren't there, I told some stories, and I said the word dick about three times more than the faculty of this university was prepared to hear. I'm going to try and keep my remarks fairly brief, because it was my sense that there were a lot of questions at the end of Common Hour. And we have a fairly limited amount of time, so I'm going to say a few things. I know that I'm supposed to talk about my personal story, but I only am going to a little bit. Because, as it turns out, once you're already a transsexual and a gender outlaw and a queer artist and cultural worker in the Bush administration, you've pretty much wandered away from the rules and regulations far enough that nobody can make you do anything you don't want to do anymore, except take off your shoes when it's time to go through the line to get on a plane. One of the things that I really wanted to talk about is transsexual narratives. So I'm going to kind of question the question of tell your personal story, which is, you know, undoubtedly satisfying to the theory people in the room. For me, that question is problematic because I feel like there's an expected answer. What? You making theory jokes? Awesome. No, yeah, the right answer is yes. I feel like there's an expected answer. And the reason I feel like there's an expected answer is because we only hear two kinds of trans narratives. We hear the deceptive transsexual narrative, and we hear the pathetic transsexual narrative. So the deceptive transsexual narrative is, who's seen the movie The Crying Game? Right? You know, or heard about the Gwen Araujo trial. You know, the deceptive transsexual is the one who deceives people into thinking that he or she is really something they're not. And then at the end of the story or the movie... Is there a dog? Okay. I thought I heard a dog barking. At the end of the story or the movie, all is revealed, and then we discover the true sex of the person responsible, and various bad things happen to them. And of course, we all understand that various bad things happen to them because they're a liar and a fraud and, you know, whatever. Who's heard about the Susan Stanton case down in Florida? Okay, so Susan Stanton, who was formerly Stephen Stanton, is the city manager of Largo, Florida for 14 years. And is, you know, sort of a model city employee in the way that is, you know, perhaps not super interesting. You know, got the budget in on time. You know, made sure there were plenty of parking spaces. But, you know, did her job the way she was supposed to for 14 years as Stephen Stanton. And then went to work one day and said, as it happens, I'm a woman and I'm going to be transitioning and from now on you're going to call me Susan. And they fired her. Why? They fired her because they decided... They fired her because they decided that someone who was so deceptive could not be an appropriate city employee because who knew what else she was lying about? Right. So then there's the pathetic transsexual. And the pathetic transsexual is the one with the terrible story. It's the sort of poor me, terrible things have happened to me because I'm a transsexual. I was kicked out of my house, and I can't get a job, and no one will date me, and certainly no one will sleep with me, and my life is very hard and awful, and you should feel bad for me, because I'm, you know, pathetic, and extend me some human rights, you know, whatever you think is fair, because I'm very pathetic, and my life has been so hard. Also problematic for me. Partly because some people's trans experience is not awful. Some people's trans experience is, in fact, great. One of my lovers and I have a running joke about the fact that we see it as our personal mission to make being queer and trans seem like a lot of fun, and potentially even better than being straight, and certainly that we are having far more interesting sex, and so you should really think about it. I'm just saying. But it becomes this sort of pity off, right? It becomes what a friend of mine refers to as pity poker. Who's had a harder life? Whose misery is more miserable? You know, whose narrative is more sad? And that's the person who gets the empathy of the crowd, or the sympathy of the crowd, anyway. So whenever I'm asked to tell my personal story, I'm always aware that there's some level on which that's what I'm being asked to do. I'm asked to tell about, being asked to tell about the hard parts. You know, nobody is asking me to come and talk about all the days when being a tranny is lots of fun. Or when it's kind of secretly a pleasure. Like in the story about my grandfather. Earlier today, I told a story about how when my grandfather was dying, I spent a lot of time sitting with him at the hospital in the hallway, just holding hands. And how the nursing staff would repeatedly come by and sort of give me a particular smile. You know, warm, a little surprised. Like, oh, look at the big guy being cute with his grandfather. There's something very satisfying about that for me. As a feminist, it's deeply satisfying to portray a feminist masculinity, to portray a connected and emotionally available masculinity in a way that isn't possible or wasn't possible for me as a woman, you know, or if I am considerate or thoughtful in some other way, or engaged or compassionate or emotional. For me, those are great things about being trans. I enjoy them, they're lots of fun, and I think that they're important work. I could just as easily talk about things that have been hard. What friends I've lost, what nonsense I've gone through with my relatives, what's been difficult for me in terms of religion, what great excitement I get to enjoy every time I try and get on an airplane that has nothing to do with taking off my shoes. But part of what I'm doing is choosing to tell a different part of the story. I'm choosing to tell about my feminist masculinity and how that's satisfying. How sometimes I go to karaoke at the local bowling alley. I do. I'm a karaoke rock star. I'm coming out right now. And I stand around with a bunch of guys. And one of them says some egregiously sexist or homophobic thing. And I get to say, you don't get to talk like that. Do they hear me if they think I'm a woman? No. They think that I'm another complaining woman. But as a man, I have an agency in that situation to stop sexism or to stop homophobia in a way that's not available to me otherwise. The ways in which that's problematic are a totally different speech. But sometimes it's great. There are people who are intensely attracted to me because I am a transsexual. People who are specifically interested in my transsexual body and my transsexual sexuality. I get a lot of play. That's great. This kid in the third row is like, you can't possibly be serious. That's so upsetting to me. I do not want to think about that. Please move on. But it's true. That's a great thing for me about being a transsexual. I get to do a lot of really fun naked things with a lot of really appealing naked people. Because I'm trans. Wahoo. I get to have a sense of myself in the world and what qualities are intrinsically about me that is conscious about gender and separate from what I've been told is or isn't appropriate about my behavior. Raise your hand if anyone has ever in your life told you that you should or should not do something because people of your gender do or don't do it. So that's what, everybody? So this whole trans thing is not just something that's about me. Like, tranny show and tell is fun and all, but gender rigidity and the gender binary influence everybody. Who knows who you would be, what you would do, what you would like, how you would feel, if you had been allowed to be and do authentically what comes naturally to you for your whole life. If you'd never been told, boys don't cry. If you'd never been told, be a man. If you'd never been told, that's not ladylike. If you'd never been told, girls don't do that. I was told, I have actually been told all of those things. Well, because one of the things that happens when you're a transsexual is you say, as it turns out, I'm a dude, and then people start giving you dude advice. Don't walk like that. Guys don't walk like that. They walk like this. You gotta stand up differently. Speak lower. No, Not that low. That sounds fake. Speak higher. You can't wear your pants like that. In fact, don't wear those pants at all. Come on, I'll take you shopping. You have to learn about sports now. You know, we're going to go to a game and watch people sweat. You know? No real guy would ever talk to women like that. You're too nice. You're not nice enough. You're too polite. You're listening too much. You shouldn't do that. You should sneer and walk away. No. Don't do that. You look too nice to sneer and walk away. Stand and be thoughtful. You know? If you act like that, people are going to think you're gay. Well, I am gay. No. They'll think you're a gay guy. I kind of am a gay guy. Oh. You know, there were great things about being trans. And now I consult my notes. How long have I been going? Who's keeping the time? All right. Who cares? She says, all right, I'll do one more. I have four things, but I'm only going to do two, I think. The other piece is about language. It's about creating language. Because one of the things that comes up in conversation all the time is, I don't know how to talk about you. What are you exactly? How does this work? What are your parts called? Explain to me how you're a homo. It's very confusing. And I understand that. We don't really have language for it. And everybody gets up and defines a list of terms with a different definition, which is worse. You know, Chris Talbot gets up and says, sex is this, gender is that, transgenderist is this, transsexual is a different thing, and everyone goes, okay, and diligently writes it down, because she's a professor and she knows what she's talking about, and she's smart and interesting, and everybody listens. And then Julie gets up with her PowerPoint and says, sex is this, and gender is this, and, you know, everybody is erasing. I'm like, oh, I must have written it down wrong in the, what's it, and crap. The fact of the matter is, we are in a point of explosion of language talking about trans topics, transgender and transsexual topics. Because for the first time, trans people are now claiming the right to talk about ourselves. 10 years ago you might have had Kate. 15 years ago you don't have a real life tranny talking about transsexuals. You have a much older, white, cisgendered guy. I should explain that word. So trans means to cross. Cis, C-I-S, is a science term that means two things that are on the same side. Right? So if trans are two things that are on the different side, sex and gender, different. Cis is two things that are on the same side, sex and gender, same. So, and even that point of language is interesting, because it's people who are trans wanting to say, why are we being abnormalized? Like, you're a dude, or you're a trans dude. One of them's less typical, but not necessarily less valid. And what's happened is that, 15 years ago, you would have had an old straight white guy get up and tell you about transsexuals. Very firmly, very clearly, probably with, you know, a whole lot of research to back him up. And that's how you would have learned about it, and that's the end of it. As we are allowed, as we're able, as we are, I'm going to say, claiming the right to talk about ourselves for the first time, as I get to get up in front of you, and Julie does, and a bunch of other people, and talk about our own lives, we're also making our own language. You know, we are claiming the right to speak about ourselves in the same way that ethnic groups, racial groups, and all other kinds of underrepresented groups have claimed that right as we have gained a voice. You know, none of you is old enough to remember the movement from Negro to Black to African American. But seriously, it screwed everybody up for a long time. Because people didn't know what they were supposed to say, and everyone they asked said a different thing. And then they get in trouble for saying the wrong thing when the guy they talked to yesterday said, you should do this thing. And it's the same thing with trans, and we don't mean to, and I'm sorry for anybody who's gotten yelled at for using the wrong word. But it's exciting to me. Because I suddenly feel like I have this whole book. I have this whole new language to talk about myself. To talk about my friends. To talk about my life. To talk about my body, my sexuality, my relationships with other people. So you'll forgive our exuberance as we try and figure out what words we want to use to talk about ourselves and each other. It's under construction. It's a work in progress, this language. Not unlike some transsexuals ourselves who are in a process of transition. Even after whatever medical things we're going to do are done, there's still a whole day to have. Right? They're still coming out to a whole new set of people every day. You know, like the guys at the bowling alley. Or whatever. Actually, I think I'm going to end there. Thank you.
Did a little. I want to make one thing perfectly clear. Thanks to my spouse. I only get naked with one person. Although it sounds interesting. How many of you know your gender? Do you have any problems when it comes time to check that little box? What if someone told you that the box you checked was wrong? How would you feel? How would you respond? Depressed? Anxious? Upset? That's my world. I grew up thinking I was a girl. Those were my first thoughts. My playmates in grade school and preschool were girls. When it was time for races, I played with the girls. It just seemed to make all the sense in the world, and I enjoyed being with them, and I enjoyed doing the things they were doing. It was late fifth grade when I realized through a combination of verbal and physical abuse that if I wanted to live to be a teenager, I needed to stop that. And so I put on macho. I was really pretty good at it, such that by the time I was in my junior year of high school, I was president of the student council, president of the band, president of youth group at church, and a few other things. I was a jock, lettered in three sports, made the all-city team in basketball in the small town of Chicago. So I played macho pretty good. Yeah, that's not bad for a short white guy. But in that whole process, I had begun to shut down emotionally. I dared not let anybody know who I was. I had a lot of friends in high school, dated a lot. The relationships didn't last very long because they really weren't very romantic. There were relationships that were more conversation. Girls would talk with me because they'd say, well, you're not like the other guys. Little did they know. Why? I knew why, but I wasn't going to tell them. You got to remember that this is back in, I hate to admit it, back in the 60s. A lot hadn't been done. Transgender was just starting to be researched and talked about, even though it's existed for centuries and millennia. I never heard the word transgender until I was 52. And then I found out I was one. I knew what I was dealing with all my life, but I didn't have a name for it. Emotionally, I'd shut down. I could talk emotional, but in terms of expressing my feelings, I just didn't dare do that. Because people would then know who I was. And then I fell in love with Joanne in college. It wasn't easy in a lot of ways, but we did fall in love. And we got married between my junior and senior year and her sophomore and junior year in college. Not an easy time to get married, and I'm not recommending it for anybody. Like many transgender people, I was convinced that if I got married and settled into normal roles, it would go away. It didn't. And so all of my life, from late grade school till I was 52, any opportunity I had to cross-dress, at least that's what I thought it was at the time, I did. It didn't give me sexual pleasure. It just felt right. And it relieved a lot of stress that I was dealing with in my life. Like many people who are dealing with something that they don't want to talk about, I was very busy. In college, I worked 40 hours a week and went to school full time. After college, when I was in the ministry, it was a 60-hour week every week. When I was in high school, I was rarely home more than one evening a week. I just needed to keep busy because if I wasn't busy, I'd stop and think about it, and I didn't want to do that. During this time, in terms of discovering what it was. That didn't happen until just a short time ago. It was November 2003. Joanne was away for a bridal shower in upstate New York. I had some time alone to dress. But I also went on the computer, and I honestly have no idea why I did it. But I started to put in some of the things that I've been dealing with all my life, some of the feelings, some of the thoughts, some of the actions. And the computer talked back to me. It identified and put a name to something I'd been dealing with all my life. And all of a sudden I knew, wow, this is me. It was a combination of exhilarating and scary. Exhilarating because I now knew that there were other people like me. You know, I wasn't alone in this world. In fact, just recently, the insurance industry in the United States has put out some data that they have done some research on. They suggest that in the United States alone, there are 20 million transgender people. 2% of those, they would identify as transsexuals. That's roughly one in 250 people, which means on a campus like this, there's probably four, maybe five transgender people. The GLBT population on this campus is probably 150 to 200. You don't know that many because many are still closeted. They don't dare let it be known, like I didn't dare let it be known. When Joanne came home, we had a conversation. I disclosed with her what I'd been dealing with all my life. It was the first time she knew. As you might imagine, she didn't take it well. For the next 6 weeks, we spent a lot of time praying, a lot of time crying, a lot of time talking, a lot of time reading. In bed at night, I would read to her about what transgender was, and we would talk about what I read. Near the end of that six-week period, Joanne reached two conclusions that allowed us to go forward. We've been married for 35 years now. The two conclusions she reached were these. One, I love the person and not the package. And two, because we both have a very strong faith, one of the things she had wrestled with was, is this some kind of perverted sin? The second conclusion she reached is, if this is sin, it's God's job to convict and not mine. And I'm going to love Julie, who became Julie, John, who became Julie, for who she is, and let God take care of the rest. Ironically, in that whole process, we've both grown in our relationship with each other. We've both grown emotionally, intellectually, and even spiritually in that whole process, which is something that a lot of people have some difficulty with. When a transsexual transitions, everybody that stays with them goes through a transition as well. Catherine Kubler-Ross has written about the stages of grief. And people that stay with a transsexual person who transitions go through those same stages. They're denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And they aren't sequential entirely. They kind of loop back and around, back and around, back and around. And friends that stay with you will have to wrestle with those kind of things, in part because they're grieving a loss of a person who no longer is. And it takes that grief process for them to accept the person that now is visible to them. It's the same person that's been there all along in a different package. More authentic, more real, more genuine. I resonated so much with what Bear had to say about being a transsexual is fun. It's exciting. It's energizing. Being able to get up in the morning and be authentically who you are is one of the neatest things on the planet. Most days it's good to be me. Not every day, but most days it's good to be me. And it's a very enjoyable thing to do. When I began to discover what was going on in my life, I decided that I needed to get it validated by someone else. Because I really wanted to be sure that this was what I thought it was. I had self-identified myself as a transsexual. I went to a counselor. She said, you don't have any emotional problems, you're stable, but you've got this one thing, and let's talk about it. And so over a period of time, we talked, because I really wanted to know where I was in that whole continuum. I knew I was transgender, but how bad was it? You know, from what I had read, it could be as bad as having to get surgery and live full-time in the other gender. through the process of conversation, the therapist helped me understand that where I was much more towards the severe end of the scale. She had me see an endocrinologist to rule out any other kind of medical thing that might be causing that, and the endocrinologist ruled it out. My primary care physician also confirmed the diagnosis, in part by the way I responded to hormone replacement therapy. And later on, it was confirmed by a Christian counselor, which the university insisted that I see. The Christian counselor, I'll tell you more about that later, but that was a lot of fun, by the way. Because the hormones were starting to make some evident changes in my life. I was still living as John to the world that I existed. At home, Joanne said, be who you want to be. Outside, I was living as John, and it was terrible. We lived in constant fear that we'd be discovered. And eventually we realized we couldn't keep living this way. We needed to tell some people. So we started by telling our kids, and then our parents. My mom and dad have been very accepting. My parents have been married 58 years. My dad introduces me to people as his daughter from his first marriage. He has a perverted sense of humor like me. But they've been very, very supportive and easily call me Julie. And it's neat. There's no nicer sound than hearing your own name as you see yourself. And it's something that so many of us take for granted. The first time I had somebody greet me as Julie, I mean, it was one of the neatest days of my life. And it's something that we just too simply take for granted. But telling people was difficult. The hormones were starting to give some evidence of what was happening and changing in my life. And so Joanne and I said, well, you know, we're going to have to talk to your boss at least. So we had my boss over for lunch and started to tell her the story. And she says, I already know, which made our jaws drop and our eyes bug out, usually the response we get from other people. And we said, how? Well, we'd been at her house about a month before for a social function. And after we left, her daughter came up to her and said, I think John is transgender. And Natalie, my boss, said, no, I don't think so. And her daughter, who's a medical doctor, having worked with transgender people and had transgender patients, said, I'm about 99% certain. And if so, he's going to need all the help you can give him. My boss immediately said, you'll get it. And she kept her promise. But she felt she needed to tell her boss, with my permission, and then her boss felt she needed to tell the university president. So on December 5th, 2006, Joanne and I met with the president, the academic dean, and my boss, the dean for the School of Adult Studies, and shared with him what I was dealing with. I'd given some things ahead of time to them, and they seemed to understand those fairly well, and generally seemed to be willing to accommodate what I was dealing with. I was pleasantly surprised and hopeful, but it became very obvious in a very short time that my hope was ill-placed. A lot of my job responsibilities began disappearing. My public appearances were minimalized significantly. As part of my job, I had traveled all over the state doing presentations to faculty. We have 15 different sites in the state of Michigan. And then I traveled all across the country giving presentations on behalf of the university. All of that disappeared. It became obvious to me that I'd have to make some kind of proposal that everybody could live with. So I suggested a lateral move that allow me to keep doing the kind of things I'd been doing. I developed 3 graduate programs for the university that were highly successful, 2 undergraduate programs that were highly successful. I had taken the university from no online presence to a very huge online presence, including some entire programs that were available online. Those are the kind of things I like to do as well as teach. And I suggested that I could do some of that from at home. Sounded like a win-win situation to my boss, sounded like a win-win situation to her boss. I presented it to the president. He said, I'll get back to you. It sounds pretty good. A month later, they got back to me with a proposal. The proposal was not a lateral move. It was a demotion, a 20% cut in pay, a contract that would prohibit me from talking with anybody on the university connected with the university about being transgender, which at that time included a brother, a sister-in-law, a niece, and my middle son. If I talked with somebody about being transgender, I couldn't identify myself as a Spring Arbor University employee. Those were just some of the things that were part of that. The other one was that I needed to see a Christian counselor. They didn't think the other ones were good enough, apparently, and they wanted me to see a Christian counselor. I responded in writing that I felt many of the things that they were doing or suggesting were probably illegal. Others were just totally impractical. And I suggested some changes that I thought were reasonable. They said, we'll get back to you. A month later, they presented exactly the same proposal all over again with an ultimatum, take it or leave it. By this time, it was the end of April. Almost impossible time to move in academia. And the proposal they gave me till mid-May to decide, but the president said I need to know in 3 days. So Joanne and I talked about it. I was feeling a lot of pressure, a lot of turmoil, but I took the contract with the hopes that given time, they would come to understand it and accept it. After all, what they taught at both the graduate and undergraduate level at the university was exactly what I was practicing, both in terms of the diagnosis and the treatment. I figured, well, if they're teaching that, they certainly should be able to practice it. And so I took it. That became a very difficult period in my life, as you might expect. I was pretty much isolated from all my peers. There were a few people that knew what was going on and took time to meet with me in clandestine locations and talk, but it was very difficult. August 2006, I was sitting in my living room in the rocking chair that I have by our fireplace in our condo with a 9mm pistol in my lap. I had composed an email that began with the words, by the time you read this, I'll be dead. I really felt that that was the only way out. I just couldn't go on anymore dealing with this. On the precipice there, what made me hesitate was love. I realized I love my kids. I have 3 boys, 3 daughter-in-laws, 2 grandsons. I love my kids too much to do that to them. I love my spouse too much to do that to them. And as I thought about that, I also realized I did not want hate and discrimination to claim one more victim. And so I put that gun away and talked a little bit with Joanne about it that night. She had recognized the signs of depression. She's a registered nurse, and so I went to the doctor and was put on antidepressants and remained on them for about a year. They're wonderful drugs. Good living through pharmacology is a wonderful way of life in a lot of ways. I didn't want to do it, but I needed to do that. And it became apparent pretty soon that choosing to live wasn't enough, that I'd also have to choose to fight back. In late October, I received a letter from the university that said, I may have possibly violated the spirit of the contract. I had been very careful not to violate the contract. I didn't want to give them any excuse to fire me. They said I had violated the spirit of the contract by going golfing with some Spring Arbor University employees who were friends of mine for a non-university golf outing fundraiser for the local high school. I didn't go as a woman. We didn't talk about trans things, but just my association with them they thought was a violation of the contract. It wasn't. They thought I had violated the contract by going to the local grocery store with a Spring Arbor University t-shirt on. I went as a man. But they thought I was identifying myself as a Spring Arbor University employee, and people might know that I was a transsexual and make that conclusion unnecessarily. 3 days later, I filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It was trick-or-treat day, October 31st. You know, I thought it was a pretty appropriate day to file a complaint. My attorney and I had been talking about it for some time, and we filed a complaint. And immediately, the university did a couple of retaliatory actions. I found out with some friends at the university was surprised and shocked by my actions. You see, people think that transsexuals are embarrassed about who they are and will go away and quietly off into the woods. In fact, they used to teach that in the standards of care. Create a fictional past about who you were as a woman or as a young girl growing up. Move someplace else and start a whole new life all over again. Divorce your spouse. It's not going to work. And go forward. We decided to break almost all those rules and stay together and go forward in a different way. that kind of staying together was hard. The university was surprised that we weren't going to go quietly away. They were shocked, but they didn't want to mediate. As a faculty member, they had to let me know by January 1st if they were not going to renew my contract for the next year. I was not tenured because I just moved to a full-time faculty position. I had been in administration before that. December 30th, Saturday, I received a letter saying that they would not renew my contract. Joanne and I talked. At this point, I was totally powerless. There's nothing I could do. We decided there was no sense anymore in trying to resolve it quietly. At this point, the only people that knew about the EEOC complaint were the president and a handful of people that he had told. I had a friend at the local newspaper who I had told my situation to and said, if you had a story like mine to tell, who would you have write it? And he gave me the name of a reporter. I called the reporter and said, I can't tell you who I work for, but this is what I'm dealing with. And if you want to know more, go and see Ken, that's my friend at the paper, and he can tell you the details. I was going to still honor my contract. He went, 5 minutes later, called me back and said, we need to talk. So he came out and talked with Joanne and I for about an hour and a half the first time, an hour later, on a later time, and then a number of times by phone and email over about a three-week period. We knew the story was going to be coming out, so Joanne, I helped write it. Actually, I wrote it, but Joanne sent out a letter to everybody on our Christmas list, all our neighbors, all our colleagues at work, so that they would hear from us first rather than seeing it the front page of a newspaper, which is where it ended up. And so she had sent the letter out. We only received two negative responses out of the 120 letters that she sent. And everybody else that we heard back from was very supportive and encouraging. That meant a lot to us. February 4th, this year, Super Bowl Sunday, I went to get the newspaper. Front page, above the fold, banner headlines, my picture, university seeks to fire transgender professor. There was another story on the Living Today section, almost the whole front page plus another section later on. Although there were about 2,600 words, which is a lot, and eight full-color pictures. I was outed pretty quickly. One of the most familiar faces in Jackson, Michigan now. Within 6 hours, the Associated Press had picked up this story, and it had gone national in blogs and newspapers very quickly. It was told in New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, papers coast to coast, in at least six different countries that I know about. This story was also picked up, blogs all over the place. In the middle of March, if you'd put my name in on Google, you would have gotten about 18,000 hits. I mean, the story was everywhere. Wall Street Journal story came out, and the reporter told me that was the first time they'd ever written about a transgender person in the Wall Street Journal, which is very conservative. Most recently, in May of this year, Newsweek did a story that had a picture of Joanne and I about it, and we were recently interviewed with Christianity Today. I'm anxious to see how that story comes out. From February 4th to the middle of March, when we finally settled with the university through mediation, I was averaging two or three media interviews a day. Print media, radio media, television, and a total of well over 80 interviews. The students on campus had a rally. The alumni were sending letters to the president saying they would no longer give to the institution, they would no longer send their kids there. The university was all of a sudden ready to mediate. And so over 2 days of mediation, 13 hours, we reached a settlement that we could describe as quote-unquote mutually satisfactory. That settlement allowed Joanne and I to do a lot of public speaking. Joanne still works as a registered nurse, and whenever she can travel with me, she goes, because her part of the story is in many ways more moving than mine. But we travel together and talk about that. I want to tell you one part about the story of Joanne and I. Right before it came out in the paper, when I knew it was coming out, I said to Joanne, well, since everybody's going to see my picture, I might as well transition and live full time now, right? She said, no. I was driving her into work, and the rest of the trip was icy silence. I picked her up that night. She wanted to talk more about it. I wasn't ready. When we came home, I gave her a letter that I had written to her. We've communicated a lot that way over the years. It's a nice way to get out everything that you want to say, let the other person absorb it, and then talk about it, which is what we normally do. She read it and then at dinner time wanted to talk about it, and we talked. She started probing and asking some questions, and I broke down. She saw for the first time, you remember I had had about 45, 50 years of keeping this covered. She saw for the first time the pain that I was dealing with and was moved significantly. We both had things to do, and so we went to different parts of the house, and I was down in my office in the basement, and she brought me down a letter that she had written. I want to read you some of what she wrote in that letter. See if I can find it. Yeah. My love is for you. My discomfort is linked to others who have little place in my life compared to you, so I will stand with you. Be who you are, you will always have me. You are my love. Never worry that my love cannot stand the pressure. God will give me the strength I need. I keep that letter on my bulletin board. From that moment on, two very strong and active lifetime GLBT activists were born, and both of us are very much committed to that. In talking with universities and colleges, we're able to share a little bit of our own personal experience, but also share a little bit of our hearts. We spoke at Michigan Pride from the steps of the state capitol to a crowd of about 3,000. Afterwards, a woman came up to Joanne and I and said, thank you for, you know, your speech, yada, yada, yada. And we, you know, said thank you very much. And then she said this. She says, I'm leaving from here to find my transgender son and reconcile with her. That made it all worthwhile. And we tell our stories in part because the more people hear the stories, the more people have a chance to understand. I want to finish today with a little bit of what I shared on that day. In May of this year, I was in Washington, D.C. Joanne and I were there together to lobby for hate crimes legislation. And again, as I said earlier today, if you have not called your congressman, even if you aren't registered to vote, call the congressman in your district. He works for you. Tell them to support H.R. 2015, which includes gender identity and gender expression in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. I would ask you, beg you, implore you to do that. It's an important piece of legislation. We were there for that. We were honored at a press club, National Press Club reception for our work with transgender people. And we had a little free time, so we went to the Holocaust Museum. If you get a chance, go there, but plan on doing something fun afterwards because it is one of the most sobering, heavy experiences ever. We took the longer tour where you see a lot more of the exhibits you got to pay extra for, about 4 hours. About 3 hours into it, it dawned on me why I was in so much pain in going through it. Throughout history, the pattern of hate that the Jews experience has been exhibited again and again and again. And I'd like to suggest for your thinking that pattern of hate directed at LGBT people still exists today and follows the same pattern. It starts with propaganda. Lies is another word for propaganda. Joseph Goebbels was the propaganda minister for Hitler's Nazi Germany. He said this, if you tell a lie often enough, people will believe it. And that is still happening today. The Family Research Council, a bogus research institution sponsored by James Dobson and other right-wing Christians, and I use that term advisedly, says their research proves conclusively that on average, a homosexual person has between 105 and 1120 different sexual partners a year. And you thought you were doing well.
I am way behind, clearly.
You got a lot of catching up to do.
Damn.
No wonder the good die young. You know, it's just unbelievable. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of some of the lies they tell. But they repeat them enough on their radio shows that people are starting to believe them. You see, the purpose of propaganda is to bring about a sense of fear. And in Nazi Germany, it worked this way. It still works this way today. Fear about some agenda from those people. Fear for their kids. Fear that they'll lose their jobs to those people. Fear of a crumbling society. Fear of the loss of the institution of marriage. And I could go on and on and on. Fear then brings about hate. Hate for people for who they are, not what they have done. Just because they are this kind of people they are hated. And that hate was intentional. It was orchestrated by the lies and by the fear. And then all of that, the next step in that whole process is isolation and discrimination. In Nazi Germany, people were hurled into ghettos. They were not allowed in public places. They couldn't have jobs. A lot of people are surprised to know that in most of this country still today, you can get fired for being gay or lesbian. They don't need any other reason. Some states have protection. Some businesses have protection. But legally, they could still fire you just for being gay or lesbian or even worse, transgender. That's changing slowly, but it still exists. And it's the same kind of pattern. And then the final solution in Hitler's Nazi Germany, what he called the final solution, was extermination. Now, if that sounds like a little bit too much of a stretch for the analogy, let me ask you this question. Do you know people who think the world would be a better place without gays, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender people? Yeah, you do, don't you? How do you think it's going to happen if you don't exterminate them? Whether it's physically, whether it's emotionally, whether it's in jobs. I met a couple weeks ago with a PhD student from the university, from Michigan State University, that done research in Detroit. Her research showed that 40% of the youth, homeless youth in Detroit, were LGBT throwaways or runaways. People that had to leave the house or were thrown out of the house because they are LGBT. Many of those are in drugs. Many of those are sex workers because that's the only way they can make any money. That's what happens through that whole process of extermination. To that crowd at Lansing, I said this. We're not going to let hate win again. When they use propaganda, we will respond with truth. We will out the lies and the liars, truth will out. When they use fear, we will respond with peace. The soul force peace of Mahatma Gandhi, of Jesus, of Martin Luther King Jr. We will resist, but we'll do so in peace. When they preach hate, we will tell our stories with love and about love. Love will triumph. When they seek exclusion and discrimination, we will respond with inclusion and acceptance. With open arms, we will welcome all who are willing to stand with us. We are family. When they seek to end our life physically or socially, we will live. We will live with joy. We will celebrate life. We will live loud and proud. Hate will not win again. The 18th century statesman Edmund Burke said this, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing." You seem like good people. But if you do nothing, evil will keep on winning. What are you going to do?
Yes. 105 to 1120, really?
Got some catching up to do.
Seriously. In fact, I have to leave right now. It's already October, and I am way behind.
Paul Cameron. The researcher. The bogus researcher.
The researchers.
Yeah. You can ask anything you want. If we don't want to answer it, we'll tell you.
Your church community, did they support you?
If you didn't hear the question was, did my church community support me? Yes and no. The church that I was attending, that Joanne and I were attending, we sang in the choir. I was on the board of elders. Whenever the pastor was out of town, I'd preach in his absence. We were asked to leave. We've remained friends with some of the people from that church. But a colleague at the university went to her pastor and said, would Julie and Joanne be welcome here? And at that new church we went to, we went from the very beginning as Julie and Joanne. At the other church, they would have had to go through the transition with us, and they just didn't want to do that. For a variety of reasons, most of which are based on fear. We found a new church home where we are warmly accepted. We knew February 4th, the day this story came out in the paper, would be the make it or break it Sunday, because we had said nothing about it to anybody there except the pastor. And that day, a lot of people who thought I was just a tall woman found out differently. They came up and person after person after person said, you know, we're with you 100%. We're glad you're here with us. So later that month, we became members of a Presbyterian church.
Hi. This is maybe a bigger, kind of more of a theoretical question, because I'm teaching a course, a first-year seminar on masculinity. So it's called Stand Up and Be a Man, and I don't think anybody's here tonight. I've given them a lot of extracurricular things to do, but I'll make them listen to the recordings if they go on the website, because it's important. I have a question, though, in doing some reading for that class and some things that some students have sent me. I'm really interested in the way that the powers that be, I'll say the media, I'll say government, are very invested in the gender binary. That it's constantly written about. We see a lot of hand-wringing articles about boys, for example. Myths about boys. What are we doing to boys? Girls being bad. These sorts of things. And I'm really interested in how being transgendered works in the power structure. And in society. Because there's a lot, an exhausting fight. I mean, Julie, your story sounds like, in a lot of ways, part of that struggle against it. I'm curious ways we can troubleshoot, discuss collectively what we do with this power structure that's so invested in the gender binary. I mean, already, I love the term gender hacker. It's such a great, or was it gender jammer? Was that it? Okay. So that seems like a productive notion, but I'm interested in hearing anything you might have to say about working with a power structure so invested in the binary.
Well, I mean, so the first part of my answer is that it's so long that I actually ended up writing an entire book about it. And my book, which is called Butch is a Noun, is basically an entire book about what it's like to live in a masculinity that's not mandatory. And all of the ways in which that becomes problematic, exciting, difficult, you know, dangerous, and so on. My experience of masculinity is that, like femininity, it is both more and less complicated than people think. But my experience of masculinity is also informed by misogyny and feminism. There is a profoundly misogynist belief that masculinity is somehow natural, and that femininity is artificial. When we think about the stuff of femininity, we think about makeup and high heels and hair-related items that I never understood and still don't. When we think about masculinity, we think about things that are far more intrinsic. You know, no one, when you say masculinity, no one thinks, you know, boots. Like, that's not the primary... That's not the primary objective. Because culturally, we have this bias toward masculinity. There's also a lot of research that shows that masculinity is the cultural default. Suzanne Kessler and Wendy McKenna, in a groundbreaking study done in 1980... look it up. You'll find the one. Did extensive sociological research. It's called Gender and Ethno-Methodological Approach. And they were able to pretty conclusively show that in this culture, it takes four feminine cues to overwhelm one masculine cue. Pretty much, if you have a visibly masculine trait and you want to overcome it, it requires four feminine traits to get there. Which is why people on the transmasculine spectrum, people who are female-to-male transsexuals, people who are masculine in their gender, even if they are female in their sex, have so much less difficulty blending in and doing what we call passing than people on the transfeminine spectrum or people who are male to female transsexuals. We have a much wider range of acceptability for men because there's more cultural leeway. There are short men and tall men and fat men and skinny men and men of various, you know, amounts of body hair and secondary sexual characteristics and whatever. And nobody really, I mean, outside of, you know, perhaps a few unfortunate junior high school locker room experiences, no one actually suggests to men who are somewhat transgressively masculine, even if they're sharers or criers or, you know, couldn't grow a beard to save their lives or have sort of capricious facial hair like I have or whatever, no one suggests to them that they're not a man. With femininity, the barriers become much more narrow. There is sort of an acceptable range, and it's quite small. You know, people who transgress it get tagged with a sort of bad kind of gender transgression much faster. It is, in fact, there have been, I don't even know how many television commercials and print ad campaigns in which, you know, the deceptive transsexual, and it's always a female-to-male transsexual, I mean, a male-to-female transsexual, gets invoked. What was the one? It was a beer commercial, and it was just like a year and a half ago. You're nodding at the back of the room because you know which one I mean. It was like, you know, you see this sort of gorgeous blonde bombshell walk through the bar, you know, and she turns around and she kind of casts this really flirtatious gaze at the two guys sitting at the table, and they, of course, predictably are like, you know, and then the action freezes and the tagline is, you know, she used to be a man, but the beer's the real deal, or something like that. And it's a big joke. Everyone's like, ha, 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 drink Heineken, right? Which, whatever. I mean, I used to work in marketing, and I don't, but that's neither here nor there. The point is that there's a narrative about femininity that it's so narrowly constructed that if you transgress it, you get accused of being a man, which is, of course, the worst possible thing to accuse a woman of, being insufficiently feminine. And, of course, all of that is troubled by class because, you know, among working class women, it's totally acceptable to, you know, have short hair and short nails and, you know, wear jeans and boots and do work all day. And it's not acceptable for men to have, you know, fancy clothes and manicures and look tidy all the time. Whereas in upper and owning classes, the reverse is true. Men can get manicures and spend $3,000 on a suit and go to the tanning salon and primp and have chin implants and whatever. And that's basically acceptable. But femininity, which is considered more rarefied, more delicate, becomes the prized thing. So, and I'm aware that I have now sort of gone on elocution safari here, and I'm just talking about masculinity, which I could do most of the day. So I'll stop.
But what?
But Julie's going to talk about it now.
I was just going to add one other thing that I think sometimes we forget, is that our Judeo-Christian roots are patriarchal at the core. You know, and so the power structures that we have come from that culture that, in my opinion, mistakenly, it takes some passages of scripture and causes women to be subservient because of them. And that culture still has informed our thinking, even though we've rejected. I would identify myself as a feminist. One of the places I spoke at recently was the National Organization of Women's National Convention. They actually wanted someone there to talk about how now could be supportive of trans women, which I thought was way cool, that they wanted that discussion to take place. But that patriarchal society, you know, who is it to determine that women are the weaker sex? You know, weak is a word that's not a good word. Well, it's a bunch of big white guys. You know, and we have to stop thinking about start thinking about where those labels have come from and what was vested in the use of those labels, because they are destructive.
No, that's me. I'm sorry. I just realized that every time I moved, it was making a little noise. I didn't want that to continue.
I just had a question for Bear. Earlier today, Julie described when she realized that she wanted to make her transition. Do you remember a specific time in your life when you realized, and if so, can you please share it with us?
This is another way in which I am a little bit non-normative. There really was never sort of the moment. From the time I was a fairly little kid, was, in terms of gender, pretty masculine. And in some ways that was made very difficult for me, particularly by my parents, who were not super interested in me being a little tomboy in any way. And there are horrifying photographs of the result of some of their attempts to feminize me, including some really exciting 80s hair with the sort of a, you know, with the bangs that are like this, and then the sides that kind of with the round brush, you know, and
the
whole...
Did you bring the pictures?
No. No, there's... No. You know, and blue eyeshadow, which is totally not right for my skin tone, and like the whole deal. And they were convinced that I would someday learn how to be sufficiently feminine. It's not that I didn't. I mean, I'm a lot of things, but I'm not an idiot. It's not that I didn't recognize what it was that they were trying to get me to do. I saw how it was supposed to work. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And every new shopping trip for new, you know, clothes at the Limited was a whole fresh torture for me. And involved sort of all kinds of, you know, screaming and yelling and carrying on, and the purchase of some extremely upsetting clothing items. Because in addition to the fact that I was a totally non-gender normative kid, I was also a fat kid. So not only did I not want to wear girl clothes, but hardly any of them fit me anyway. So my mother was determined to buy me whatever would fit me, and that was a big problem. Because most of the things that fit a fat teenage girl at that time were... Well, let's just say there was no Lane Bryant. There were no cute clothes for fat girls. There was no Torrid. You could forget about it. It was like, here's your tent. Congratulations. Don't you feel cute? Good, get out. That'll teach you to lose some weight. So, I mean, as I left home and started buying my own clothes and started, I mean, you know, because a lot of it's a process of agency. You know, you buy your own clothes. You get your own haircut. You get your own haircut, and it's a few weeks yet before your parents see your new haircut. You know, you start getting dressed under no one's scrutiny in particular. You buy your own underwear for the first time. And, you know, every time I had a choice to make, it was a masculine choice. And it was never that I felt like, it was never, for me, a studied masculinity. It was never, what will make me look most like a boy? It was, what do I want? And I kept reaching for what I wanted. Over a fairly long period of time, considering what is now more common, I eventually reached a point where there was just nothing feminine left about me, with the exception of my, you know, occasional hand-holding, baby-cooing, public-crying behavior. All of which persist to this day. I'm a sucker for little kids. I'm that guy. I'm like, oh, it's such a... It's such a look at the little toes. But my dad's the same way, so I feel like that's totally fine. So there was not... I mean, you know, eventually I had to have sort of a stern conversation with some of my relatives about, you know, that it was time to stop giving me a load of crap about how I dressed and cut my hair, or I was going to stop coming home. And we have gone around about that some. They didn't really take me seriously, and then I made good on my threat, and then they were sorry, and then I started coming home again, and then they were assholes again, and then I stopped again, and I mean, you know, like, it happens when you have parents. Well, I mean, who hasn't gone 18 rounds with their parents about some choice that they've made that their parents don't agree with, whether it's your major or your friends or the person that you're dating or the way you dress or whatever it is? Maybe a couple of you. You know, I'm sure there's a couple of, you know, people in the audience who don't have those kind of conflicts with their parents, which I think that's great, but I'm not one. So there was not kind of the day the trumpets sound and I come out as a man. No one, you know, people say, how did your friends react when you told them? I never told anybody. You know, it was just sort of a, this is kind of how I exist in the world phenomenon, which is admittedly quite different than some people's trans experience. But I didn't have the kind of flash of light. And I didn't have the, and now I have to tell you something. I had to come out to my parents as queer, which I did by letter, which I think is a great plan. Also, so that they wouldn't find out about it in the newspaper, which I think is a good plan, too. Because it turns out that no one's parents really enjoy finding that sort of thing out via the newspaper. I have been like this for a long time.
One of the things that I've learned in this visit, and Bear and I have talked about, is there are some generational differences. You know, growing up, there just wasn't any possibility for gendered expression when, in the ancient days when I grew up. You know, Bears had some advantages. The next generation will have even more advantages because society has moved to a more accepting, or at least tolerant, perspective of gender diversity. And so one of the things that I've, in people my own age that I've talked with, is that, yeah, we wish we had been born at a different time because, you know, when we grew up, we had to hide it. So when we came out, you know, one of the things that is always bizarre is when someone comes out in their late 40s or 50s, they go back through their adolescence, especially in their choice of clothes. And it's not a pretty thing. In many ways, you're trying to experience what you wish you could have experienced growing up.
Well, and also hormonally, you're going through puberty again.
You are.
Yeah. High acne, high mood swings.
What high mood swings?
You know, all of those things that normally happen, or those things that happen when you're 13, then you go through puberty all over again because it was so much fun the first time.
Is that the reason?
Yes, that's why I did it. I couldn't get enough of that good clear cell smell.
One of the other things that that Bear talked about was those changes in terms of male to female, female to male. The hormones, if it's female to male, the hormones make passing a lot easier in the sense that they bring out facial hair, the body bulks up, you even get male pattern baldness, the voice drops. For male to female transsexual or transition, the hormones produce a lot of changes, but if you're growing bald, your hair doesn't grow back. It grows back a little bit, but not enough. Your voice won't drop. You have to learn to speak in a register that is a little higher than you're normally were used to speaking. I'm still working on that. And so there are some differences that Bear was alluding to in terms of that transition. In our culture, it is much easier for women, male to female, or female to male, to transition. Because, you know, you can put on loose clothes and nobody knows you have breasts. Or you can bind them, you know, and nobody knows. And so that transition process is a little bit easier in one sense, you know, and harder in other ways. But it's never easy.
No. And you start to play this sort of ridiculous internal game where you thin slice everything. And you start to ask yourself the most insane questions. Like, if I go into the men's room and I sit down to pee, will other people hearing the sound of my pee know that I'm sitting down because I don't have a penis? Raise your hand if you've ever been in a men's room.
Raise your hand if you have ever raise your hand if you have ever considered the sound of someone else's pee. So it's really just a couple of you then, is it? All right. So clearly, no, in the men's room, because the men's room is totally different. Men's room and the ladies' rooms are totally different. The ladies' room is a social experience. You could have a whole afternoon in. I'm not even kidding. You could have a whole afternoon in there, right? Like, how, you know, you're in the ladies' room and someone's like, oh, I wish I had a button. Oh, I have a button. Everyone's rummaging through their purses. They're chatting. Oh, is that your son? Yeah, he's 2. Oh, my God, 2 was a really hard time. Chat, 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 chat. Meanwhile, in the men's room, nobody talks.
Nobody
looks at each other. It's like, I am all alone in here. If I look at anybody else, they're going to think I'm a big homo. Like, even if you're talking to somebody when you walk in, you stop immediately upon crossing the threshold, just in case somebody thinks you might be gay. You definitely don't look at what anybody else is doing. You could be, I don't even know what, performing open heart surgery. Like cooking a steak. You could be needle pointing in there. Nobody is looking at you at all. Right? See? You know? Which is why female-to-male transsexuals have so much easier time using the men's room than male-to-female transsexuals have using the women's room. Because in the men's room, I guarantee you nobody's looking at me. Even if they think maybe I'm a little bit of a funny shape, even if they're not really 100% sure that I'm definitely a dude, they're not going to say anything. Because if they say anything, it means they were looking at me. And nobody's going to cop to that. Where in the ladies' room, everybody's looking at everybody. Oh, I love those shoes. Did they still make that color of lipstick? I always thought it would look really nice on me. Oh, do you want to try it? Sure, I'd love to, thanks. Like, that does not happen in the men's room. You know, nobody's like, I like the smell of your deodorant. Fag. That's it, you're done. You know, culturally, these are hugely different experiences. Also, women get a little nervous when they see someone that they think is a man come into the bathroom. Whether or not that's a reasonable fear, because there are, in fact, almost no cases of assault against women that happen by men in the women's bathroom. Though there's certainly plenty of cases of assault by women on women that happen in the women's bathroom. But women get a little nervous because there is a culture that men are dangerous, that men are predators. When a woman wanders into the men's bathroom, no one's worried that that's going to be a dangerous situation. It's like, oh, hey, look. You know, or guys assume that the line at the women's bathroom was too long, or whatever the thing is, like, it doesn't seem scary, or dangerous, or even necessarily terribly out of the ordinary. It's just another thing. So suddenly you become aware of all these tiny little details that you never ever thought about before, that you just go through your life with. Suddenly, they're the difference between being safe and being unsafe. Right? Like, they're the difference between getting through your day without somebody having a big gender panic all over you and having to stop and deal with somebody's gender shit.
And that's something we haven't talked about, is the fear of violence. You know, violence, the hate crimes legislation that has passed the House and the Senate makes it clear that attacking people because of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression is a hate crime. That's desperately needed. You learn, you know, as a trans woman, you learn to behave like any other woman. When you go to the parking lot, you park near a street light. You know, you look around before you go to the car. You know, when you're a guy, you just march out there and go to the car. But you change the way you live significantly, in part because of a fear, not just gender fear that's normal, but transgender fear as well. You know, I've never had any problem in the women's bathroom, but they may come where it'll be a problem with somebody. You know, I don't know what I'll do with
it. Yeah, but you're cute, so it's
thank you. I did tell some students a story earlier that I was in the women's bathroom recently. In one of the throughway rest stops in Ohio, and I sat down, and all of a sudden a hand came up. It wasn't a senator. Hand came up from underneath with some toilet paper, said, I think you'll need this. And I looked, and yeah. And she said, you know, here you go. I said, thank you very much. I said, the moral of the story is I need to look before I sit, right? And she said, yeah. I mean, that wouldn't happen in a guy's room. But it happened there. And, you know, it's some of that socialization that you talk about, the way of behaving that's different. I mean, to some extent, your whole life changes in a lot of ways that you might have taken for granted at one time, but no longer take for granted.
Do you find that the longer that you live as a trans person, the less often that you get like that look of like, are you male, are you female, or if you even get that, and how does it make you feel when you encounter that, if you have?
I'll answer very shortly, and then Bear can answer long.
hey.
One of the things that I've discovered is if you live with confidence, nobody asks. Nobody questions you. And I've worked with other people who might have difficulty presenting. We had one person visit our house. He was looking for a place to go, was afraid to go shopping, was all dressed up really cute and passed very well, but was terrified of going out in public and asked if she could come to our house. And Joanne and I both said, sure, fine. You know, and they came and we talked for a while. And I said, you know, just go out with confidence and nobody's going to, you know, if you go out timid, people are going to wonder, you know, well, why is that person acting so scared? Why are they looking around furtively? You know, but if you live with confidence, it'll happen. And so this person was ready to come to our place again. I said, we won't be here, which was true. I said, go out to the mall and do some window shopping. She didn't have a lot of money. And she was petrified of doing that, did it, and wrote me back and said, I had a wonderful time. Thanks for encouraging me to go out. And so part of it is just learning to present with confidence. And some of what we've been talking about is behind that, because it takes time to get some confidence about your new gender roles. Some things you just do naturally. I've never talked with my hands in the past. I do all the time now, and it just feels, you know, it just naturally. There's other things that I've wanted to do all my life and now can do. I do all the cooking in our house. I love to cook. And it's just a creative outlet for me. I'm not a very creative person in a lot of ways, but in cooking I can be creative. So, yeah, you make some changes, but it goes back to what we've been talking about in terms of authenticity. You know, if you are who you are, go ahead. I don't care if I'm made. You know, if I'm made, I figure it's their problem, not mine. If they have a hard time with it, it's their problem, not mine. And I'm not made very often. I think sometimes I might be made and don't know about it. I can live with that. I mean, there's nothing more delightful for Joanne and I going out to dinner and the waitress coming up and saying, ladies, you know, what will you have? She gets a good tip if she starts that way. Short answer, no, it wasn't, sorry.
No. Well, I just, you know. It's probably a little longer answer than that. You know, it actually really depends on where I am. Most places, I have very little difficulty. You know, I'm a big guy. People don't look at me and think, oh, clearly that's a girl. Though, you know, there are some gender transgressive things about me as a guy, like that I wear two earrings and, you know, share and cry like that. Sometimes in places where there are a lot of visible trans people, San Francisco, New York, some neighborhoods in Toronto, I'll get longer looks. People will be like, interesting. Once I went to see a gender therapist and I went in and I said, I'm a transsexual, and he looked at me like, oh, you are not going to be a pretty girl. Just... like, just, it was clear as day from his face. It just fell like, oh, that's not going to go well for you, buddy. And I had to hasten to clarify, no. I was born female and I'm living as a man. He brightened right back up. Oh, that's okay. I know people who have various kinds of difficulty with it. Every once in a while, somebody still will call me she.
And often I'm more befuddled than anything else. I just sort of think, I wonder what they saw. Because I don't feel like I look particularly girly. So there's obviously something
at work.
It's
when you're crying over the babies.
It's the cry. It's the babies. It's not. It's in the convenience store, almost without exception. I don't know what that's about. Yeah. Is it problematic? It doesn't really bother me. I mean, I know some people that it will ruin their whole week. They feel like they've failed. They feel like it's a condemnation of them in their expressed gender. They, you know, go home and search their faces or their bodies in the mirror, trying to figure out what that's about, what happened, how they were moving or speaking at the time, so they can eradicate it and never do it again. I don't...
Life's too short for that.
I hesitate to say that because I know it's really important to them, and I don't want to trivialize that emotional experience. For me, it doesn't take on the same kind of importance. But then, I'm also not that attached to the gender binary. So, if every once in a while somebody thinks that I'm a particularly masculine-looking female, it's not like it's that far from the truth. You know? I don't take it on as some sort of personal failure.
Well, and the one spot that is, you know, that people think about is security when you're going through the airports and all of that. My driver's license, my passports still have an M on them. I've never had a problem. The only time I ever had a problem was before I transitioned. I flew to London, gave court testimony on a Tuesday, and flew home on a Wednesday, which is not recommended. But coming home, I got frisked in London up close and personal. And this is when I was about a year and a half into hormones, so it was very personal. And, yeah, that can happen. But once I've transitioned, I haven't had any problems. So we don't know where the problems are going to come. Is there someone over here? Here and here.
Just wondered about the last point that you made, Bear, especially in light of your description that says who does not identify with any gender group.
Yeah, I didn't actually write that, and I'm not really sure how that happened.
Okay.
Can you repeat the question that you answered?
Well, maybe it doesn't apply, but the description in the blurb that we got said that Bear does not identify with any gender group, and I was just wondering, you know, how that means for someone who I think has a pretty masculine presentation. Sounds like you use or think of yourself in masculine terms.
I don't. What I would say is probably that I don't identify with a sex. I am certainly neither male nor female. I like to think of myself as a hearty blend. Thank you. Yes, I will accept applause for that. Because of, you know, how my hormones now are and how my body is now... how my body now exists. If somebody said to me, are you male or female, I would have to say no. You know, certainly I live in the world as a very masculine person. Gender-wise, I think my gender's really clear. Am I a man? I don't know. What's a man? You know, do I have the same experiences as a man? Which man? Him? 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 I don't know. Sometimes people ask me if I feel like a man, and I say, I don't know. You know. And then if I have the opportunity, I'll reach out and, you know, grope the nearest guy. Be like, I don't think I feel like him. Kind of. I'm not really sure. But there's a, you know... And now you're glad you sat in the third row. I'm just picking on you, and I'm sorry. It's just because you're such a good sport. You know, there's, you know, we talk about man and woman like we know what those things mean. And I don't really think that that's true. I don't think there's a way to be a man, and I don't think that there's a way to be a woman. Though never really having been a woman, I feel less able to say for sure. It doesn't seem like it, but I don't like to talk about what I don't know. Mostly.
I was going to relate to that whole confusion thing. When the box asks sex, I'll put an M. When it asks gender, I'll put an F. If it asks sex, I'll put an M, but then right underneath it, gender, and put a box put F in it. So I did it. And that's a very difficult thing, you know, to try to understand. Harvard and their applications, their MBA program, has male, female, or transgender that you can check on their applications. Kind of a wild concept.
I never fill in that part of the form. I leave it blank. And then when I hand my form in to whoever you hand your form in to, depending on what kind of form it is, they always have to fill it in for me, which I find extremely satisfying in a slightly perverse sort of way. Because I just feel like if there's not a box for me, then I'm not going to check a box. That, you know, I'll just leave it blank. And that, but sometimes it leads to people. The interesting thing is that no one ever asks me. No one ever says, you didn't check off a sex. Do you want me to check male or female? They pick up the piece of paper. They see that I have not recorded my sex or my gender, depending on which they're asking, which they don't tend to notice that those two things are actually different. Take a look at me, as though that were enough to tell, and they make their own decision and they file my form. Not my fault. Do your thing, man.
Julie, you finished your presentation when you were sort of doing the formal presentation with a call for action for all of us here in solidarity. And I'm just curious to hear a little bit more about that in terms of what is possible, what can we do.
Yeah, I'm not going to presume or prescribe a certain set response. I think each of you have to kind of look in your own heart and mind and go with where you come out. And Bear can make some suggestions too. But I've obviously talked about ENDA. I would encourage you to get behind that and tell your friends to get behind that. Call your congressman. Be supportive of that. The other thing I'd encourage you to do is get to know some people different than you. You know, if it's trans people or gay or lesbian, whatever, get to know them. Take the time to hear their story. You know, take the time to find out who they are as people. One of the things that I had professors do in classes that I've met with over the last year is the professor will ask, how many in this room know somebody who's gay or lesbian? Let me do it tonight. How many know somebody who's gay or lesbian or trans or not, including us? All right, just about everybody raise their hand. If I'd asked that question 20 years ago, the number of people that raised their hand would have been 3 or 4. What's changed? Well, it's people telling their story. And once you hear somebody's story, hate is a lot harder. You know, hate in the abstract is very easy. But hate when you know someone who is LGBT, red, yellow, black, white, you know, you fill in the blank, all of a sudden becomes much, much more problematic. And so I'd encourage you to take the time to know people, make friends, do some reading. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of good literature out there, some bad literature too, but that's true of just about any topic you can think of. And just try to come to some level of understanding. One of the things we often talk about is, you know, it's almost impossible for you to get your head around where somebody who's transgender or transsexual's head is. But you can try. You know, and I can't speak for Bear, but if you try, I'm happy with that. You know, I hope you can get there. But if you can't, if you're willing to try, I can live with that. Because I think if more people try over time, it'll happen. So I'd encourage you to do that. I think there are three places that you can be vocal that will have a lasting impact on our society. One is your place of employment. If they don't have a non-discrimination policy that includes sexual orientation, gender identity and gender expression, push them to have it. 195 of the corporate 500 companies now have it. And when you talk about sexual orientation, it's even higher. And corporate America is getting what Capitol Hill isn't. Okay, and they're leading the way in this regard. Universities and colleges, that's the other place to keep pushing the message. It's, you know, the next generation is hope for change. And they get it. You know, gender, sexual orientation are not as big a deal for you all as they were when I was in school, you know, and maybe even when Bear was in school. They're not that big an issue anymore. The third is religious institutions. there are churches and faith groups that are supportive of LGBT people. And there are others who haven't been. We're starting to ask the right questions. And I really am convinced that changes at those levels, plus the local municipalities, are going to be the catalyst for change on Capitol Hill. You know, a lot of times things start at the top and work their way down. I don't think it's going to happen with gender identity and gender expression. I think it's going to happen with towns like Carlisle getting a non-discrimination policy in their book. And as more and more towns get it throughout a state, the state's going to wake up and get it. And as more and more states get it, the federal government's going to eventually get it. So, I mean, those are little things that you can do anywhere. Get some kids' books that talk about sexual orientation and gender identity. It, you know, they do it in gentle ways. What's the one? King and King, isn't it? Oh, there's a children's book about not a king and a prince and princess, but two princes that get together. You know, it doesn't talk about anything sexual, but it's the classic fairy tale with two different characters. And it's a way of helping people grow in their understanding of the rich diversity that, in my opinion, God has given to the world and needs to be celebrated. So, that's a, you know, you need to find what you're comfortable, and not everybody is comfortable with all the things that I've mentioned. I'll pretty much go anywhere to talk about LGBT rights, because I've only refused one interview, and that was a shock jock that I knew wouldn't work well. and so, you know, if people are willing to listen, I'm willing to talk. And if just one or two in a group like this changes their mind and grows, it's worth it all. You got some other ideas?
Stand up for me when I'm not there. Mm-hmm. This is great. You guys are smart, and you're thoughtful, and you're present, and you're engaged. And, you know, I talk to a lot of audiences, and it's always easy to tell who's really paying attention, who's hearing me, and who's just sort of sitting in the seat until somebody tells them that they're allowed to go. You know, because they're there for class or whatever. Stand up for me when I'm not there. When someone's making queer jokes, you know, just like I get to do in the bowling alley. When someone's saying some misogynist crap, and I get to say, don't say that. And I get to be taken seriously because I'm not a woman. However problematic that is, and oh, it is. It's also something I can do. Stand up for me when I'm not there. When you hear homophobic jokes, when you hear people making fun of someone because they are gender non-normative, when someone asks you if you would be willing to hire someone who's queer or send your children to a school where the professor or the teachers are trans, or, you know, sit down and have dinner with someone who is in some other way non-normative. Stand up for me when I'm not there. There's no, I mean, Julie's right. There's no way to continue prejudice once the monolithic them becomes erased. You know, you can assign any quality you want to a whole group of people if you've never met any people like that. My favorite new statistic is this. Among people who know four or more out gay people, they are seven times more likely to favor gay marriage. Now, I have my own issues about the whole gay marriage debate. We can talk about that another day. You have to invite me back for that. But just knowing out gay people totally changes people's worldview about gay marriage. I'm guessing it's not because those gay people are actively campaigning
you know, to get their friends to go and think differently about gay marriage. It's because it becomes present. It becomes personal. My father, back when I was a lesbian, used to joke that he was going to take video of me and my now ex-wife bickering and just make it into television commercials. You know, gay marriage, just like straight marriage. You know? There we'd be. Honey, have you seen my keys? No. Where did you leave them? I don't know. I thought you had them. Why would I have your keys? I mean, you know, there's nothing different about that. And it's not that knowing four or more gay people makes you somehow a more enlightened person. It's just that it breaks down the themness. You know, then you know actual gay people, some of whom you like and some of whom are probably jerks. But it's no longer... The girl in the fifth row was like, yeah. Actually. You know what? That's fine. Believe me, I know plenty of queer... I know queer people who are total jerks. No doubt. But it creates that possibility, right? Like, once you have queer folks in your life, if one of them's a jerk, one of them's a jerk. It's just another person who's a jerk. It's not that all gay people are jerks. You know, it changes the whole arrangement. And it's reciprocal. The more people come out and are accepted, the more people feel free to come out, and the more queer or trans people you know, and the faster change gets made. Right? Can you see that as a cycle? So, if I'm not around, tomorrow after I leave and go on to, what's tomorrow, Friday? Pittsburgh. Don't let people who weren't here get away with their same old shit. That's plenty for me.
You remember in the civil rights movement, one of the things that has come out of that is we're much more careful about our language. That's one of the ways you can do that. Don't let people use terms that are demeaning or pejorative, you know. A faggot is a stick that you throw on a fire. It's not something that has anything to do with sexual orientation. So don't let people use it that way.
For the mic to kick on. You mentioned that 20 years ago we wouldn't have had nearly as many hands with gay people, you know, do I know a gay person and so forth. And I was, 5 years ago I was actually pastoring an MCC church, and that was where I first learned to, you know, have actual friendships with actual T people. It was really scary. But one of the things that I'm wondering, I used to talk about when folks asked me out as the pastor of the gay church to explain T people as though I had any right to do so, was I used to say, well, you tend to find that most T people, most out T people are older because they've had time to go through life and acknowledge who they are, and they're old enough now that they're not at risk of, you know, XYZ. My question is this: we're finding that gay people are coming out much younger and much younger and much younger. Do you think that, you know, is T following G, L, and B? Are we going to see T people coming out earlier?
We already are. We're totally seeing it.
Oh, yeah. Counselors now in high schools and grade schools are being trained to recognize some of that gender confusion, gender dysphoria, if we have to use that term, and work with kids. One of the things that's just mind-boggling to me is that if they're giving kids hormones that keep puberty from happening so that the kid at the age where they want to make a decision can make the decision. And that is awesome. You know, it's because you don't have to go through puberty twice. and it's happening. I don't know if any of you saw the Barbara Walters special. But that was an awesome special where there were three different kids. One of them was a kindergartner who the parents said, if you want to wear a dress to kindergarten, you can. I mean, that's awesome. And that child is going to have a better chance of not getting screwed up by our society than others. The other one was just about ready to enter high school. And the third was someone, the third was a female to male, like in junior high, who was going to transition while in school, with the support of parents, the school counselors. You know, it's happening. And I think that's a very, very healthy thing. Part of what part of why there were so many old farts like me transitioning is that when we grew up, it wasn't the opportunity for the expression that there is now. And so we went into that denial that I talked about earlier at great cost. I'm conflicted on a daily basis. On one hand, I would love to have had my life all over again, to live as a woman the whole time. On the other hand, it would have meant I wouldn't have met Joanne, wouldn't have the three boys I have. You know, so there's a conflict there in my head all the time related to that. But I'm so glad that kids now won't have that conflict, won't have to have the regrets. And I just think it's a wonderful thing. Places of employment are recognizing it. Police are being trained in it, you know, so that they can recognize it and not harass people when they pull them over for a ticket because it doesn't look like you in your driver's license. You know, and I'll tell you a funny story about that, too. I told some of the students earlier. When I went and got my driver's license changed, by then my picture had been in the paper significantly. When I changed my name, that made the front page of the paper, okay? In the small city of Jackson, the transsexual is big news, okay? So I was a front page story, I don't know, 8 or 10 times over a period of about 5 weeks or 5 months. But anyways, when I changed my name, I was there and you know, we were having a conversation and they asked, would you like to, you know, have your birth certificate, your gender marker change? I said, I'd love it. They said, have you had your birth certificate changed? I said, no. Well, we can't. You know, and in Michigan, you can't do it without surgery. It's a whole other story. But as I was leaving, I'm walking down, and about where this gentleman is sitting, there was a guy, a huge guy, 300-pounder, leather coat, chains, shaved head, the whole business. And in his deepest, huskiest voice, hey. And I just kind of turned and looked, and he says, don't let those holy rollers give you any crap. You know, so you never know where you're going to get the affirmation. It's growing more and more everywhere you go. And kids are getting it. You know, it really is exciting to see. So I think that gives me a lot of hope for the future. You know, it really does. It's an exciting time to be a transsexual. You know, it's fun to be who we are. If you want to join us, we'll have a sign-up list afterwards that you can all... There's one more question.
I don't know if we're allowed to take one more question. Andrew's getting conflicting signals from the powers that be. Please tell me that your name is actually Andrew.
It is.
Excellent.
All right, can you give it a microphone?
Sorry, I'm sorry.
The microphone has all power.
I was just going to ask, to what extent do trans people who subscribe to more of a genderqueer identity and don't fit into that binary, where then a trans identity is also trying to perhaps fit someone into the same gender binary, just the different gender binary. And if you could speak to that a little bit, if I'm making any sense.
I'm sorry, I don't actually understand your question.
I
need you to try again.
Yeah, I'll restart. To what extent do you think that perhaps society, in an overarching term, expects the M to F trans person to then subscribe to rigid feminine gender norms, or the F to M trans person to just then describe to rigid male gender norms or masculine gender norms, and to what extent does that then just reinforce the binary of gender? I mean, it disrupts it, but then almost reinforces it at the same time, so I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, or recommend.
I mean, why am I wearing a skirt? Why?
Exactly.
We're wearing a tie?
Basically. Okay.
I love this tie.
I do too.
I think that there are I mean, that is like a 9-part answer, and I recognize we don't have time for that, so I'm going to try and be brief, though it's not really my best skill. As Julie has so tenderly pointed out already, one problem is that
for trans people, and I think it was you actually who made this comment earlier today about trans people and gatekeeping, medical gatekeeping, was it? Was that you who stood up and said that smart thing? No, you in the white hat. Apparently not. Okay. Well, some young guy said it. So if you are a transsexual and you want access to medical stuff, if you want to have hormones, if you want to have surgery, if you want to have if you want to have genital surgery, if you want to have any other gender confirmation surgeries, you have to go through the medical establishment so that they will approve you as being sufficiently transsexual, whatever that means. And in order to be deemed sufficiently transsexual, you have to be masculine enough to convince whatever gatekeeper...
Or feminine enough.
Or feminine enough to convince whatever gatekeeper that you will be good at being a man or good at being a woman, which is why my story about going to a therapist and saying I'm a transsexual is sort of funny and also sort of horrifying, because if I'd been assigned male at birth and I had been trying to transition to a woman, they would have told me no and sent me away. For not what?
I think to some extent...
Wait, I actually want to hear the end of that sentence.
Well,
have taken...
I've taken into account the gender binary.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were saying. Well, I think to some extent, transsexuals and transgender people, whether they like it or not, still do buy into a binary model. Okay, and that's a radical thing to say, and I don't like myself for saying it, but part of it is... we're like anybody else. We want to be accepted. And we'll push the envelope as far as we can, but that's just part of it. The other part of it is, you know, why do you get up in the morning and choose the clothes you choose? It's because they're the clothes that you feel good in, and it seems like a fit for that day. I think for transgender and transsexual people, it's exactly the same thing. Whether or not everybody else agrees that those clothes are appropriate or not is really not that big an issue. But to some extent, I enjoy feminine presentation. You know, around the house, I'll wear a T-shirt and short shorts. Shorter shorts than my wife wears, but we have a home. She's the fashion police sometimes. But we have good discussions, but it's just what I'm comfortable with. And to some extent, I think we do buy it. You know, it's ingrained in who we are as a society. It's ingrained how we go up. Yes, we've transitioned. Yes, we're different. But our difference is somehow still connected with that binary. I mean, it's a hard question to ask, and it's even a harder question to answer, I think. It's still there. It's to some extent, it's like this, okay? On the college campus, everybody wants to express their individuality. So everybody does it by wearing blue jeans and a T-shirt. Okay? It's pretty much the same thing with transgender people. They want to express their individuality, but they do it in a way that, to some extent, buys into some societal norms. That's my take on it. But
I think I feel a little differently.
I'm not surprised.
So I think my answer is both yes and no, right? Like, even separate from what trans people are sometimes required to do in order to have access to trans surgeries and hormones, there's also the fact that, am I confirming the gender binary if I'm an out trans person? If I run around saying, I'm a tranny, I'm a tranny, I'm a tranny, I was born female, does that confirm the gender binary or complicate it? If I, you know, hold hands and cry and coo at babies, am I confirming the gender binary or troubling it? You know, there are things that I do that are transgressive in my masculinity that would be that would not be transgressive with if they went along with femininity, and vice versa. So, on the one hand, I think it is possible for a transsexual narrative to support the gender binary. Because there is a sense, right, of saying, I have these parts, and this isn't what I feel like in this society, so I'm going to make a social transition, or I'm going to make a physical transition, so that I can see myself and be seen in a way that feels more authentic. If we could explode the idea of normative gender, and everyone could just, you know, have whatever they have and do whatever they're going to do, and everybody would be cool with it, would people transition? I don't know. You know what? I'll tell you what. You do that, and then I'll let you know. And, you know, people who are genderqueer or gender fluid or gender adjacent or however they or sometimes we describe that, I think that the reason that it's complicated is because it flies in the face of the idea that you have to have one gender and it has to match your sex. And that if your gender and your sex don't match, then you fix one of them so that everything matches up again. Matches up again. And when we say matches up, we just mean is what's typical in society. There are a lot of atypically gendered people in a variety of ways, some of whom are transsexual or transgendered, and some of whom are just special. And I think, I hope, that talking more about gender norms, about gender traction, about gender rules, I mean, because we love a binary. Right? We love a binary because we love traction. You know, even Julie and I have already started to find traction with each other. She's the good girl, I'm the bad boy. Right? Like, we met this morning. We exchanged 2 emails before this. You know, I'm pretty sure that her behavior and my behavior aren't nearly as polarized as they seem, but it's fun, because gender's fun. And there's traction there. We have something to play off of. So she gets to be the good girl, because that's fun, and I get to be the bad boy, because that's fun. And we have our own little binary going that actually has nothing to do with gender. So some of the reasons that binaries get exciting is because they are interesting. Because having, you know, if you're Romeo, you want Juliet. Even if Romeo and Juliet are both biologically male people, there's some sense of a foil. You know, if you're Sherlock Holmes, you want Watson. You know, there are ways that gendered pairs happen, all kinds of ways that gendered pairs happen, or ideological pairs, or sexed pairs, or, you know, humor pairs. What's, who are the two yahoos from who used to be on Saturday Night Live who were always in movies together? There's a tall one and a short one. I haven't been able to sit through any of the movies yet. Do you know the guys I mean? No, yes, thank you. That's a kind of pairing, right? They have a certain traction between them. Penn and Teller have attraction between them. You know, like there are all of these pairs and groups that have this sort of foil energy, that have this traction energy. And we like that. If you're playful, you want somebody to play with. If two people are playing the exact same game in the exact same way, it's not as much fun as if you have a little bit of action. You know, a little bit of ease in the movement. So I think, and I'm often wrong, but I think that by living in an authentic gender, that I am making more room for gender expression, not less.
There's the 2 things that I really want to resonate with. I think to some extent...
It's that thing about being the good girl, isn't it?
Yeah, no, maybe. I'm not disagreeing with it because I really think you've hit a home run here that to some extent we're still living the standards of care. You know, when you transition, they tell you what to transition to. Okay? So which is still a binary model. You know, the standards of care are binary. You know, and so to some extent that's there. But the thing that is very positive about what Bear had to say is that I think as more and more trans people can identify themselves as a trans man or a trans woman, that that binary can disappear. Because, yeah, it is a butting heads with the binary when you identify as trans. Because, you know, when you talk about trans, it talks about an umbrella that goes over both, you know.